Previously on Beta.
The whole expression punk royalty should not exist. There's no such thing. I mean, we were a bunch of scruffy little scallywags.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe.
What the hell is that? I don't know what the hell that is.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, film journalist Nick DeSemlian gives the candid stories of the comedy mavericks who ruled Hollywood in the 80s.
But there was an energy, there was a sense of innovation and an unpredictability to what all of those guys were doing that was different. They brought this new kind of anarchic energy to them.
And actor William Sanderson talks about his life as a character actor in movies and TV, including his role in the 1982 science fiction cult hit, Blade Runner.
My character was far from innocent, but Ridley Scott whispered in my ear, "This is a totally innocent man." And that's something fun to play.
But first, Vivian Goldman. Vivian is a pioneering post-punk musician and journalist. She's also the author of Revenge of the She-Punks, a feminist music history from polystyrene to Pussy Riot. Vivian's book covers her lifelong connection with the punk scene and what it was like to be the lone woman covering it in the 1970s.
Well, it trained me to be a little bit tough because you had to be tough. I mean, there was an article in The Guardian some years ago when they appointed the first woman as editor of the New Musical Express, which I used to write for back in the day. And the writer said the very few women who ever wrote there had to have the skin of rhinoceroses. And when I read that, I almost was like tears came to my eyes because I realized how much I had to really stand up for myself. I had one sort of compadre, Caroline Coon, incredible writer who's now an increasingly more acclaimed visual artist who's about to start having American exhibitions, I gather. It was just us, and it wasn't just that. It was that there was a lot of hostility among even my writers when I was features editor because they liked it the way it was as a boys' town, and they were very territorial, and they did not want to give up their power.
The title of your book is Revenge of the She-Punks. So how do you define the word revenge in this context?
Yes. When I mentioned the title to Chrissy Hynde, who's, you know, my long-standing sister and who used to come to Friday night dinners at my mother's, you know, she actually sort of, you know, she's very sarcastic and very witty and can be quite cutting. And so her response was, "I don't do revenge."
Yeah.
I say, it's not really that sort of revenge. You know, as I say in the book, you know, our revenge really is our complex survival. Mm-hmm. I can assure you that before punk came along, even in the 70s, when feminism had already begun, I can assure you, there was just about no women musicians, and those that were very isolated. There was people like the jazz piano player Annette Peacock, but these were just one-offs struggling to make their way. The women I interviewed before punk came along, when I was already the solitary female rock writer, you know, was all people like the mighty, mighty, mighty Gladys Knight.
Yeah.
Or Stevie Nicks.
Yeah.
So you see, just a couple of women who'd hung on in there in a big way, but there was no community. That, I can promise you, that only happened, Doug, with punk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. You use four themes to explore what makes punk such a liberating art form for women. Which themes did you choose?
What I settled on, and it was a lot of thinking, not only about punk, but really also about life and how we get through it. I first went to identity, then money, always a favorite.
Yes, always.
Yeah, so girly identity, who be me? Then money, are we our stuff? Does materialism define us completely? You know, and what compromises do we have to make? So then love, unlove. It's love slash unlove, busting up the binary.
Yeah.
You know, that's love and hate in one chapter. And then culminating in protest. Mm-hmm. Woman the barricades. Yeah, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk a bit about the theme of identity and more specifically the singer of X-Ray Specs, Polystyrene. Oh. You describe her as an ecstatic, visionary punk godmother. Can you tell me a bit about Polly?
Oh, Polly. I mean, she was the first black punk.
Mm-hmm.
She was a mixed young woman. She was part Somalian, her father was Somalian, and quite orthodox religious Muslim. And her mother was sort of Scottish, Irish, English, sort of Celtic, Anglo-Celtic.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a woman on the edge because really at that time, there's been an incredible rise in the number of mixed people, you know, with parents of different races and colours and so on.
Yes.
A huge surge. It's now a huge constituency, ever growing and ever more influential. But at the time it was, I'm not joking, it was sort of fairly rare. It wasn't as common as it is now.
Mm-hmm.
And then sort of cultural conflicts. Basically, her poems, as I'm saying, her songs, you know, like the seminal, "Oh, bondage, up yours." She's like, mm-hmm. "Oh, bondage, up yours." It's this exultant cry that when you hear it, it's like a call. You had to respond. You know, it's one of those things where it changed everything when you heard Polly in that song, or it did for me, and it did for so very many. And then Polly, a very complex character. She had her issues.
And it was Polly's struggle with her own biracial identity and the resulting sense of being an outsider that inspired the song Identity, which you focus quite a bit of attention on. Can you tell me about this song?
You know, she starts off saying, clarion call.
Yes. What impact do you think the song Identity had on the people who heard it when it was originally released?
Well, listen, you know, Doug, now we're living in the days of an identity industry.
Yes.
Aren't we?
Yes, we are.
It can become sometimes almost too extreme. I say in the book something approximately like, you know, you people can get so hung up on their identity that they forget who they are. But the thing is, the point about punk, one of its great, fabulous aspects, was the ability to, you know, shuck off, to dismiss the identity of your heritage, who your parents were, or you didn't know who your parents were, who are your ancestors, who cares? You're redefining yourself with punk as something that's very essentially you. When Polly sang about identity, it's like nobody was using that word.
Yeah.
That word, far from being an industry, she was implanting the idea.
Yeah. You were able to communicate with members of the Russian feminist protest punk band Pussy Riot with the help of a Russian journalist. What were the most interesting things you learned about the band from your interviews with them?
So for this book, I actually interviewed Nastya Mineralova. She was and is, you know, quite responsible for helping shape the sound. So I really liked how she described analysing and setting about creating the sort of sound that would function in a guerrilla action in the street.
Mm-hmm.
The sound that would cut through the noise, cut through the sirens. And she was very powerful in that sense.
Mm-hmm. And you write about the band's 2012 song,
Kropotkin Vodka.
Yeah, can you tell us a bit about this song?
Well, you know, all the songs in the book that you'll find on the playlist, I dig them.
Mm-hmm, obviously, or they wouldn't be on the playlist.
Yeah. I think that Pussy Riot, because of the trauma and the activism and the energy around them, you know, I think often people don't think of them musically. But personally, I think they're a good band. So I was happy to shine a spotlight also on the music.
Back in 1981, you recorded a song called Launderette, which you talk a bit about in the book. Can you tell me about that song?
Launderette is probably my little indie classic. It's been reissued so many times. It's about to be reissued yet again. And I had been in the Flying Lizards, where my contribution had attracted a lot of attention. And I was good mates with John Lydon, formerly known as Johnny Rotten. And I was also good mates with a reggae band, Aswad, particularly the bass player George Oban. So he lived near me in that ferment of Ladbroke Grove that the Clash talk about so much, under the Westway. So he just played me this bass line one day. I'm, whoa, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
It was sort of snaky and sinuous and it just grabbed me. And I just improvised this song on the spot, Launderette. And it did express the sort of cynicism about sex and love and romance of the time. It just did. That's how we were living. It's what you might call an unlove song. It's not at all romantic, but it's pretty funny. And it described the sort of brief encounters that were typical of that era, which I have to say was post-pill, post-penicillin, and pre-AIDS.
I wanted 10 pence for the dryer. Yes, that was how we met. My laundry bag was broken. My clothes were soaking wet. I felt I needed hugging.
So I wrote this little ditty, Launderette, and we put it on a cassette. So I played it to John Lydon, and he just cracked up because even I have to say it's funny. So he wound up producing it. So, yeah I was lucky with Launderette.
Hmm. Was there a particular band or artist that you talked to during the course of writing this book that surprised you the most?
Well, probably Jia Wang from Hang on the Box in China. Because she's anti-abortion, and that really did, I suppose you can call her the outlier's outlier because of that. And I had to grapple with that. I mean, she's the only one who thinks like that. But I was trying to get a handle on it because it seemed to me so unpunk, though punk is about not having boundaries in a way, but still I was shocked. And then I said to her, it's not by any chance anything to do with that policy that China used to have of using abortion as enforced population control, which we all know about, which led to the mass killing of girls.
Yes.
So anyway, she snapped back in an email, like, how dare I say that? How dare I talk about China unless I'd been to China, unless I'd lived in China? So that was my most surprising interview in a way.
How do you see the future herstory of punk playing out?
To me, it's like what Patti Smith did say when they were closing down CBGBs and turning it into a high fashion store for John Varvatos. It's got to be beyond like the bricks and mortar. It's got to be beyond where you can get fishnet tights. It's got to be a spirit, and that spirit still sustains. And that's the point I sensed and I was able to back up as a thesis in this book. It's still an inspiration, partly because it's a gateway music, because anybody can play it. That's the idea. When you get very, very sophisticated on your instrument and a virtuoso, then you have to graduate to post-punk in a way. It's hard to keep it that simple. But yes, punk still sustains, especially for women, girls. Yeah, we still need punk. Don't dismiss it just because the British government ironically backed it on its anniversary when it had tried to stomp it earlier. We still need it. It's still a liberator.
Vivian Goldman is the author of Revenge of the She-Punks, a feminist music history from polystyrene to Pussy Riot. Find out more about Vivian at wpr.org/beta.
I ad-libbed, and when we got through with the scene, I felt it went pretty good, but not as well as I could do. But I heard him rushing to the next scene and saying, I got me a tantrum. I got me a tantrum.
Character actor William Sanderson talks about his long and storied career, including his role as E.B. Farnham on the HBO Western Deadwood. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. William Sanderson is the ultimate that guy actor. He has spent almost half a century performing in TV, film, and on stage. You may know him from his role as E.B. Farnham on the HBO Western Deadwood. Or perhaps you remember him from Blade Runner or the sitcom Newhart. William chronicles his career in a memoir called Yes, I'm That Guy, The Rough and Tumble Life of a Character Actor. Sanderson was on his way to becoming a lawyer when he got bit by the acting bug.
I was rehearsing Marat Saad, and I played an insane patient and surprise. And after I rehearsed, they applauded the cast, the rehearsal. Boy, it was just a great feeling.
Yeah.
And I said, it gave me a lot of confidence. And over the years, became more of an obsession. But when I started out, it was just one of the many things I did to try to get over shyness, self-consciousness, etc.
Yeah. In the fall of 1978, you moved to Hollywood, and then about a year later, you got cast in Universal's new biopic about country music superstar Loretta Lynn, coal miner's daughter. Who did you play?
I played her uncle, and he was described as a chicken thief and moonshiner, and his name was Lee Dollarhide, and Loretta herself was on the set visiting and said, don't use his name, he's trying to sue me. Of course, we used his name.
Yeah, and didn't you originally, correct me if I'm wrong, William, but didn't you originally read for the part of her husband, Dooley, that Tommy Lee Jones got, or not?
Well, the agent submitted me,
mm-hmm.
but it was all fun. I tell a story, I'll just abbreviate it, about Tommy Lee. Loretta's real husband wasn't that thrilled with the casting of Tommy Lee Jones.
Ooh.
With whom I survived six projects later.
Yeah. Why wasn't Dooley, Loretta's real husband, thrilled with
that? I don't know. And It was Tommy that told me. I saw that he had a bandage on his head one day when we're shooting. Mm. And he had to take it off for the shot, but in the rehearsal. Well, he told me later he got a little too drunk.
Mm-hmm.
And the night before, and a cop hit him in the head.
Mm-hmm.
After that happened, Loretta's husband, Doolittle Lynn, kind of liked him, mm-hmm. thought he was more right for the part.
Right, yeah. I could see that, yeah. In 1981, you auditioned for this neo-noir science fiction film based on a Philip K. Dick novel called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? This movie, of course, is Blade Runner, and it was directed by Ridley Scott. Who did you play in Blade Runner?
Oh, I'd like to just say out loud, it's great to be in a cult film. I play J.F. Sebastian, who's called a genetic engineer.
Do you live in this building all by yourself?
Yeah, I live here pretty much alone right now.
Must get lonely here, J.F.
Mm. Not really. I make friends. They're toys. My friends are toys. I make them. It's a hobby. I'm a genetic designer. Do you know what that is?
No.
They built a fabulous set for my apartment, say, mm-hmm. Sebastian's apartment.
Yeah.
Didn't all get in the film, but makes you feel pretty good when Ridley Scott said, would you like to see it? And I walked in there, and it was mannequins and pool tables and mistakes that he had made.
Is there a particular memory that stands out in your mind from when you were working on Blade Runner?
Well, I love the direction. I guess Ridley conned me, if intellectuals are listening. My character was far from innocent, but Ridley Scott whispered in my ear, this is a totally innocent man. Hmm. And that's something fun to play, whether it's true or not. And I quit worrying about the lighting, about Rutger Hauer improvising, and just tried to make him innocent.
Yeah. It said, you say, or you write in your book that liberated you, that Ridley whispering, this is a totally innocent man into your ear, liberated you and made it more fun and really helped you. Yeah.
You know, I can only imagine if he'd said it to Tommy Lee Jones, what he'd say. But and yeah. Ridley was a tough taskmaster, but
yeah,
he's kind of a visionary. So
yeah. After Blade Runner, you worked with Tommy Lee Jones again on a made-for-TV biopic, The Executioner's Song, about the serial killer Gary Gilmore. And then your next acting gig was on Bob Newhart's sitcom, Newhart. Can you tell me about your audition for Larry, the Appalachian woodsman with the two silent brothers named Daryl?
Yeah, I don't know if I can do it without belaboring it, but I went in dressed kind of like I saw him as a tramp.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow they matched me up with Tony Pappenfuss and John Volstead, my brother Daryl, my other brother Daryl. But the live audience that Bob Newhart insists upon helped us because they applauded or laughed.
Yeah.
So they gradually brought us in more and more.
I'm Larry, this is my brother Daryl, and that's my other brother Daryl.
So, how you doing?
Okay, except I throwed my back out last week crawling under a house.
Sounds like a tough job.
Wasn't a job, I just like crawling under houses.
Do you have a favorite Larry line?
Oh, goodness. Women. You can't live with them. You can't stuff them in a sack.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great line, yeah. I've got to ask you about the last episode of Newhart. I think it's the most brilliant TV series finale of all time. What did you think of it?
Well, 30 million people watched it. It came in number one. So I was happy the brothers could talk.
Yes, yeah, they got to speak for the one and only time they got to yell quiet to their chatty wives.
Can I tell you one Daryl story? They took a lot, and they lost jobs, put the career on hold because Newhart didn't really want them to make commercials and so forth. But Tony said to me, who played my brother Daryl, he said, maybe when they want us to talk, I'll say that, look, this is working so well, I just think I won't talk.
Mm-hmm.
But he's really just showing me his mindset. But I love that the anarchy was there.
And if there's anything like this ever, you know, comes up again, you'll certainly be the first ones we'll call. I wish there was some way of making this up to you.
Well, Dick, there was that dead possum out by the well.
We'll take it.
Yeah, there was talk of a Larry, Daryl, and Daryl spinoff series, but Bob wouldn't allow it while Newhart was on the air, as you write in your book. Do you think a Larry, Daryl, and Daryl spinoff series would have been successful?
Well, somebody did because they gave us a nice amount of money for the option, but then the company, MTM, went broke. But I think it's God knows better. It was hard enough. It was a stigma to being on it. Ridley Scott's casting director, for instance, would say, they pay me to find people who haven't been on television series.
Mm, there you go, yeah. You had the chance to work with John Candy on the comedy film Wagons East in 1994. What was that experience like?
Oh, great guy, lovable guy. First one to congratulate Sharon and I getting married. And,
oh, that's great.
He liked to party.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, this is the third movie in a row he had done. We were up in the mountains in Durango, Mexico, and whatever he partied with, drinking, that's all I ever saw. But it took its toll, you know, and he was overweight. And oddly, he was supposed to be his back operated on after the movie by my good friend, Dr. Robert Watkins, that I write about in the book. But he passed away a day or two before we finished the film.
Yeah.
But he was a heck of a nice person.
Yeah.
So funny.
The bald contempt of it. Why not come out five abreast, cavorting and taunting? E.B. was left out. E.B. was left out. Make your filthy gestures. Public service was never my primary career.
In 2004, you were cast in the HBO Western series Deadwood. You portrayed E.B. Farnham, a character based on a real person. Can you tell me a bit about E.B. Farnham?
Well, the real E.B. Farnham was the first mayor, and he may have been a postmaster. He may dispense justice in the thoroughfare. He opened a business, and So I was excited when I got it. But David Milch, the great creator of the show, gradually wove my neurotic personality in there, and so I became a buffoon. Mm. But it was always fun to play, and that's not a problem for me to play.
Yeah.
But he also gave me some great dialogue that they call pseudo-Shakespearean.
What was it like for you to work with that kind of dialogue?
Oh, it was a joy. Now, if I have to recall, and sometimes they were difficult, and it was all I could do to memorize it. They'd give them to you at the last minute. But in my book, we have, if I may say, a lot of the exact dialogue, and they were just a joy.
Yeah.
But he also could be very crude and have Farnham call this Calamity Jane half-woman, and he'd have me insult the great actor Smiley Parker with words, and if he didn't say cut, I'd keep saying swine and this and that, you know. But Farnham was full of hatred. Mm.
Yeah, in your book, you describe David Milch as one of the most fascinating human beings you've ever known. He's brilliant, prolific, generous, and self-destructive all at the same time. And you say that you see a lot of yourself in David, and you believe that it's mutual. Can you explain that? What do you mean by that?
When I reread that, it looks conceited, but...
No, it didn't to me. I didn't read it that way.
Thank you. David's strong, gentle, crazy. He described himself as a degenerate gambler who gambled away $100 million.
Wow.
I wouldn't say that, but it's all in the newspapers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But... he had a gift, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? May I define talent in a crude way? Talent is doing what other people want to do. Genius is doing what talent wants to do.
Is there one scene from Deadwood, the series, that you're especially proud of?
There was one where I was scrubbing blood off the floor.
Yes.
And
yeah.
He's kind of angry at Ian McShane's character.
I'll throw Farnham a token fee. Why should I reward E.B. with some small fractional participation in the claim? Or let him even lay by a little security and source of continuing income for his declining years? What's he ever done for me? Not to mention ordering a man killed in one of E.B.'s rooms. So every free moment of his life, E.B. has to spend scrubbing the bloodstains off the goddamn floor.
Yeah, that was a great scene. That's like one of your best acting scenes ever, I think, which is saying something. And you write in your book that you actually started to ad-lib a bit, right? Because the director didn't say cut. So you...
Well, thank you for remembering. It's therapeutic to get to say it out loud. I've known that director 40 years or something, but he thought he hadn't said cut. So you keep acting until they say cut.
Yeah.
Unless you're a star, you stop whenever you want to.
Yeah.
So I ad-libbed, and when we got through with the scene, I felt it went pretty good, but not as well as I could do. But I heard him rushing to the next scene and saying, I got me a tantrum. I'm going to use it. It was David wrote the words, and I just continued.
Yeah, very true. What did you think of Deadwood, the movie?
That's a tough question. It got great reviews.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been completely satisfied with anything I did.
Mm.
But I thought Dan Minahan did a good job, the director. It was fun to do. It was fun to see my friends and people you thought were your enemies embracing you, people weeping that they got to come back. You know, you can only have one great experience in life.
Yeah.
The secret's to repeat it as many times as you can.
Yeah.
I loved the last movie of the week, especially because I didn't get killed.
Yeah. is there one dream role that you've always wanted to play?
I guess maybe a normal person.
Mm.
I'd like to play a normal person.
Yeah. Who's the closest? Of the people you've played, can you say one is the closest to being normal?
Stanley's Gig, based on a real-life character with Faye Dunaway. But it was just an independent film, but it was based on a true story about a guy who played the ukulele, and he wanted to have a job on a cruise ship,
right,
entertaining. But he was a drunk, and he never made it. But he took a job in an old folks' home, where he finds his salvation. He befriends Marla Gibbs, who is an old jazz singer. And when they screened it for The Real Guy in New York, he said, well, I can die now. And I think he meant it as a compliment.
William Sanderson, thank you very much.
Thank you again.
Actor William Sanderson is the author of Yes, I'm That Guy, The Rough and Tumble Life of a Character Actor. Find out more about William at WPR.org/beta.
It's a very, very peculiar film that could only have been made in this era, I think. This huge budget road trip musical with a car chase and heroes who have sunglasses on and you're not really sure what they're about. They're criminals, but they're eating fried chicken. It's got so much peculiar stuff going on in it.
Film journalist Nick DeSemlian joins us to talk about the wild and crazy Mavericks who ignited the 1980s comedy movie renaissance. That's coming up on Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. During the 1980s, comedians like Bill Murray, John Belushi, and Eddie Murphy made some of the funniest and most original comedy movies. Films like Caddyshack, The Blues Brothers, and Beverly Hills Cop are still getting laughs today. Film journalist Nick DeSemlian is the author of Wild and Crazy Guys, How the Comedy Mavericks of the 80s Changed Hollywood Forever. Comedian Chevy Chase was one of the first Wild and Crazy Guys to break out. He left Saturday Night Live to focus on films. His departure didn't sit well with his fellow comedy titans.
The guys back in New York, people like John Belushi and Bill Murray, were kind of annoyed that he had left. They thought he had just kind of deserted them. And when he came back as guest host, there was a lot of tension in the air that whole week. And it came to a head, like, amazingly, just before Chevy Chase was about to start the show with his monologue, he and Belushi and Bill Murray got into this amazing fracas.
Live from New York, it's Saturday Night!
They were kind of throwing punches and insults, and yeah, I mean, it was kind of an amazing story, and I got to speak to some of the people who were there that night.
Yeah, and a funny comment, what Bill Murray called Chevy.
That funny medium talent.
Yeah. But the strange thing is, though, as you mentioned, Chevy Chase left the SNL cast after its first season, and Bill Murray didn't join the cast until that second season. So why was there this bad blood between them? Because their careers at SNL didn't really overlap, did they?
You know, I had heard about this fight from reading some accounts of it, but I'd never heard Bill Murray talk about it. And I was dying to hear his take on it. So I asked Bill Murray, you know, what was that fight about from his perspective? And he said he was really the anointed avenging angel, I think he called himself, from the group. He was the guy who kind of felt like he had to stand up to Chevy Chase on behalf of the others. So I think he was certainly back in those days one of those guys who would throw himself into a kind of a fracas if there was something brewing and he was annoyed about something. He would just launch himself into it.
Sure. Did Chevy Chase and Bill Murray repair their relationship in time to film Caddyshack together?
Well, not as such. They did run into each other at a party, and there's a pretty funny story in the book about Chevy Chase marching up to Bill Murray, and everyone was kind of, what's going to happen? And then Chevy Chase kind of got down on his knees and unzipped Bill Murray's pants and kind of mimed, you know, doing a sexual act.
Right.
And the guys kind of cracked up. So they kind of, you know, there was still tension there, but not so much that they wouldn't share a scene together. And there was that legendary, iconic scene with the two of them, which wasn't actually in the script. It was kind of come up with a couple of days beforehand, where Bill's character, the kind of the crazy gardener on the golf course, has this run-in with Chevy Chase's very slick golfer.
You know, buddies for life, I think.
I'll drop by. You drop by my place anytime.
The subtitle of your book, Wild and Crazy Guys, the subtitle is How the Comedy Mavericks of the 80s Changed Hollywood Forever. Do you think that Bill Murray, John Belushi, Eddie Murphy, and the other comedians you write about were making a conscious effort to do something different and, so to speak, try to reinvent Hollywood movies?
I think so, definitely. I don't know if they were necessarily thinking of movies at the beginning. They all kind of came out of TV. But there was an energy, there was a sense of innovation and an unpredictability to what all of those guys were doing that was different. You know, I think comedy largely felt safe in the sort of the 50s and the 60s, and comedy in the 70s was very much kind of muted, and Woody Allen doing his relationship dramas and stuff. But they brought this new kind of anarchic energy
yes.
to them.
Yes, very well said. Yeah, that's the key word, anarchic. And what was going on in Hollywood at the time? What was the climate like there among the studios and the executives in the 80s that allowed them, you know, this chance to reinvent comedies and be so anarchic?
Well, the whole culture was changing, I think. I think in America in the 70s, Watergate had been going on and Vietnam was going on, and it was a very kind of dark and difficult time. When the 80s arrived and that stuff all passed, there was just a general sense of let's kind of let our hair down and let's have fun and let's have a party. I don't think the studio executives really generally knew what it was or what was going on. And if you read about Animal House, I think they were just watching going, what the hell is going on? They had no idea whether it was going to work or not.
Right, because it was uncharted territory. Very good point, yeah. You mentioned Animal House, and we can't really talk about this comedy renaissance of the 80s without talking about the frat comedy movie National Lampoon's Animal House. Even though it was released in 1978, it really kind of set the table for the 1980s comedy movies to come, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Ivan Reitman, when I spoke to him, called it the marking point. It was it changed everything, really, because nobody expected it to blow up like it did. It made so much money. People kept going back and back to see it.
I think this situation absolutely requires a really futile and stupid gesture be done on somebody's part.
We're just the guys to do it.
Let's do it.
Let's do it!
It was like a release, I think.
Yeah.
And if you look at the movies that came out after Animal House, stuff like Caddyshack and Stripes, they're all trying to kind of capture that Animal House magic. You know,
yes.
a lot of them have that same kind of slobs versus snobs dynamic where
yes.
you've got the kind of the stuffy guys on one side and the fun-loving, crazy, anarchic guys on the other. And I really think it took everyone by surprise, including the people who made it.
Yeah. What did you think of Animal House the first time you saw it?
I mean, I love Animal House. I think elements of it have not dated too well.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly some of the stuff involving, you know, gender politics and,
yes.
and the way that women are treated in it, not always good. But it has an amazing energy to it.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly John Belushi is just unleashed in that film, and he's just so watchable.
That's the movie that made him a star, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
100%.
Do you have a favorite scene in Animal House?
Gosh, any of Belushi's stuff. But, the food fight, I think, is hard to beat. Just as a sense of just pure hedonism, really.
Food fight!
And just as an expression of just sort of letting this energy loose, it's incredible.
Yeah, definitely. John Belushi died in 1982 after taking a speedball, a mix of cocaine and heroin. He was only 33. How do you think his career would have played out if he had not died so young?
Gosh, I mean, that's a great question. It's, you know, he certainly wasn't expecting to die. Like, he was lining up all kinds of scripts. I mean, for one thing, he would have been in Ghostbusters. In some form, Dan Aykroyd was writing Ghostbusters for him and John Belushi as a kind of another double act thing after Blues Brothers. And the same is true of Spies Like Us. It's another project that Dan Aykroyd was writing. So it's interesting. If John Belushi had lived, we wouldn't have got Ghostbusters, you know, with Bill Murray as Venkman and the way that people love it. So who knows whether that would have actually worked or not. But I think Belushi would have done some really interesting stuff. He was talking to Robert De Niro and Sergio Leone about doing Once Upon a Time in America. Like a lot of these comedians, he wanted to kind of do some serious stuff as well as the silly stuff. So he might have turned into a really interesting dramatic actor.
Yeah. Bill Murray didn't seem very excited about starring in movies.
No.
Yeah. Why was that?
It was a combination of things. I think Bill Murray didn't want to do just pure comedy. He was really reluctant to do Ghostbusters, for one. He only did Ghostbusters if the studio would greenlight The Razor's Edge, which was the Somerset Maugham film he wanted to do. And also, he was nervous about becoming famous. He was really genuinely trepidatious. He had seen what fame had done to, like, Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi, and he had kind of seen it as having changed them. And he was really wary of that happening to him. And, you know, when he did Ghostbusters, he did become hugely famous, massively famous all over the world, and he took 4 years off. Which is incredible. I can't think of another actor who's done that.
Yeah, especially when you're that hot, and then the fact that he was able to still come back and star in movies and make many great movies since then. What would you say was the best movie that Bill Murray made during the 1980s?
Wow. Okay. Well, I mean, the first one I think of is Ghostbusters. I just think it's so hard to think of that film without thinking of Bill Murray as Peter Venkman.
Venkman, what happened? Are you okay?
He slimed me.
That's great! Actual physical contact! Can you move?
I feel so funky.
He brings such an essential quality to that film. He has that just that really kind of like cynical sideways glance at the whole thing.
Yeah.
He's like an audience surrogate. So however silly and big and crazy the film gets, he's kind of there to say, come on, this is a bit dumb, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I think that's why the film works.
Pete Venkman's a guy who can get things done.
Right.
I wonder what makes him tick.
I wonder.
It seems to me that more than anyone else, the one comedian who really was consciously trying to change Hollywood and the entertainment industrial complex was Steve Martin. As you say in your book, throughout the 1970s, he meticulously crafted this postmodern style that Rick Moranis later described as anti-comedy. Well, what do you think?
I think meticulous is the word.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Martin was intellectual, and he would analyze comedy, and he would work on a script. You know, he worked on that script for Roxanne. It's a film I absolutely love.
Mm.
He went through draft after draft. He spent years on it, just trying to get it absolutely right. There's that brilliant scene in Roxanne where he goes into the bar, and the guy insults his nose, and he starts one-upping the guy with nose insults on different themes.
Personal. Well, here we are. Just the three of us.
Punctual. All right, Delman, your nose was on time, but you were 15 minutes late.
He workshopped those jokes to death. And so he was just very, very cerebral and would really, you know, not tell jokes so much as kind of do jokes about jokes.
And meta, very meta.
Really
approach.
Meta stuff.
Yes, yes.
He was bigger than all of them. In the kind of the mid-70s, he was the one stand-up who could fill arenas while the other guys were kind of getting started on Saturday Night Live. But he really struggled to take that to the big screen. The Jerk was not well-received.
Mm-hmm.
It got really bad reviews. I think he was really hurt by that.
What did you think of it when you first saw it?
I love The Jerk.
Mm-hmm.
It really holds up. I think like a lot of those Steve Martin kind of late 70s, early 80s movies weren't particularly acclaimed at the time, but they really hold up. They haven't dated. The comedy is so clever, so kind of absurd.
It's like I don't fit in. It's like I don't belong here.
It's your birthday, and it's time you knew. Navin, you're not our natural-born child.
I'm not?
You were left on our doorstep, but we raised you like you were one of us.
You mean I'm gonna stay this color?
But it definitely deserves all the acclaim it's kind of got since.
Yeah. Eddie Murphy was a force of nature in terms of his ambition to become a star. As you say, Murphy raced after fame like a greyhound chasing a hare. He had this huge career in stand-up comedy with specials like Delirious and Raw, and it seems to me that both Eddie Murphy and Steve Martin, they were the original first rock star stand-up comedians. What was it about Eddie Murphy that made him such a great comedian?
Gosh, just charisma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unlike Steve Martin, who was one character on stage, and then he would come off the stage, and people would be surprised at how quiet and shy he was.
Yeah,
Eddie Murphy was the same off stage as he was on it. You know, he was that guy who would act like a rock star on the stage, and then he would come off and party all night, and he would walk around wearing that kind of skin tight leather stuff and the medallions, and he had such a larger than life kind of persona that was just him.
Yeah.
But when he was a kid, he would go around, he would just tell everyone, I'm going to be a movie star. I'm going to be a millionaire. And he made it happen.
Yeah, and he was very young when he made it happen, wasn't he?
Really young.
Yeah.
I mean, he would ring up Saturday Night Live over and over again saying, I want to be on the show, let me be on the show. And they kept saying no, and then he kept ringing, and then eventually they let him on. And then when he got on, there was a long period where he wasn't given anything to do, but he kept at them, and eventually he got his break. So I think there was no way that Eddie Murphy wasn't going to make it happen some way or the other.
Yeah. What do you think is Eddie Murphy's best film?
Well, Beverly Hills Cop. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just think the sheer swagger and the self-confidence, and to do that and be likable on top of it and not have the audience kind of turn on you.
Yeah.
You know, he's got this kind of Bugs Bunny sort of spirit.
Yeah.
He's almost like a live cartoon character.
Yeah. That's...
And he is so watchable in that film. I think that film is still electric because of him.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite scene in Beverly Hills Cop?
Yeah. The legendary banana in the tailpipe scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We're not going to fall for a banana in the tailpipe.
You're not going to fall for the banana in the tailpipe?
It should be more natural, brother. It should flow out like this. Look, man, I ain't falling for no banana in my tailpipe. See, that's more natural for us. You've been hanging out with this dude too long.
The amount of laughs he wrings out of that whole concept, I think, is hilarious.
Yeah. Was there anything that all of these comedians had in common that allowed them to make such great comedy movies during the 1980s?
They all had this unpredictable edge to them, mm-hmm. which I think makes them really watchable. And that's definitely true of the Blues Brothers, which is one of my favorite films of this era.
Yeah. What did you think of the Blues Brothers the first time you saw it?
It was one of the first of these films that I saw. I saw it really young. I was probably too young for that film.
How young were you? Do you remember?
I was about 7.
Oh, wow.
I was on vacation with my family in Greece. We saw it in an open-air auditorium. I remember it well. Even at that age, I thought, this is a weird film.
1, 2, 3, 4.
This huge budget road trip musical with a car chase and heroes who have sunglasses on and you're not really sure what they're about. They're criminals, but they're eating fried chicken. It's got so much peculiar stuff going on in it, but that's what makes it brilliant. Yeah, I fell in love with that film, and I have the soundtrack on all the time, even now.
Cool. Yeah, it's a great soundtrack as well, and a great film. There were many hilarious and very talented women who appeared alongside the wild and crazy guys on SNL and SCTV, but they didn't enjoy the same notoriety and big screen success of their male colleagues. I'm thinking of people like Catherine O'Hara, Jane Curtin, and Gilda Radner. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I agree. Gilda Radner in particular, mm-hmm. I think, is it's such a shame that she didn't get some opportunities to really show her talents off on the big screen, because if you go back and rewatch those early years of Saturday Night Live, she is so hilarious.
Oh, yeah.
And the characters she creates, so much imagination.
What's all this fuss I keep hearing about violins on television? Now, why don't parents want their children to see violins on television?
It was an era sort of known as New Macho, as one of the Saturday Night Live writers called it.
Yeah.
You know, from some, I think John Belushi didn't think women were particularly funny, so I think that fed into it, unfortunately. But yeah, it's a big shame.
Dan, there's an old saying. Behind every successful man, there's a woman, a loving, giving, caring woman. But you wouldn't know about that, Dan, because there's no old saying about what's behind a miserable failure.
Let's finish up, Nick, with our lightning round of short snappers. Kind of free association, if you're up for that?
Sure.
Okay, so who was the funniest of the guys we've talked about?
Gosh, well, I'm gonna go for Steve Martin. He is just the master of comedy, I think. Steve Martin, there's nothing he can't do. He's just so hilarious.
Yeah. Who was the wildest of the wild and crazy guys?
I mean, it has to be Belushi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who was the craziest?
If we're talking eccentricity, I don't like using the word crazy too
sure.
much.
Okay.
But
the most
in terms of eccentricity, I think Dan Aykroyd is hard to beat, and it's a wonderful eccentricity. I've had the chance to speak to him many times, and he's got the most incredible brain. Just one of the most amazing encyclopedic brains, and he is so passionate about so many things, and he's a joy to talk to, but yeah, very eccentric.
Stripes or National Lampoon's Vacation?
National Lampoon's Vacation for me.
Why?
Well, it's one of my favorite Chevy Chase. I think a lot of Chevy Chase films didn't work in the 80s, but I think Clark Griswold was just the perfect character for him.
Yeah, I think I know the answer to this next one, but I'm going to ask anyway. Caddyshack or Blues Brothers?
Yeah, Blues Brothers.
Yeah. Fletch or Ghostbusters?
Ghostbusters. Yeah, I do like Fletch a lot, but there's no arguing with Ghostbusters.
Yeah. Animal House or Meatballs?
Animal House.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Beverly Hills Cop or Planes, Trains, and Automobiles?
Oh, man, that's the hardest.
Yeah.
Oh, because, I love both of those films.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I'll take Planes, Trains, and Automobiles because... it's just a perfect film, I think. And it's fascinating that your kind of sympathies change as you watch it. To start with, John Candy's playing this super annoying guy called Dell, who is annoying you as the person watching it. And then you shift and you think Steve Martin's a bit of an a** for not treating him better. And you're ping-ponging back and forth in between who you're kind of relating to. And then by the end, you just love both of them.
Yeah. And then there's, as you broke this story in your book, there's this line that John Candy ad-libs that still, when Steve Martin thinks about it, still brings a tear to his eye. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit of improvisation in a scene that didn't actually make it into the film. But it's Del, the John Candy character, talking about his dead wife and saying, this time I just couldn't let go. And, you know, in the film, it's heartbreaking. He's still carrying the picture of his wife around with him. And gradually, you see that this kind of obnoxious buffoon is actually this heartbroken guy who you just love by the end. And yeah, I mean, the end of that film makes me tear up as well. So I'm not surprised that, you know, Steve Martin had that.
Nick DeSemlian is the author of Wild and Crazy Guys, How the Comedy Mavericks of the 80s Changed Hollywood Forever. Find out more and maybe get into a
food fight
at wpr.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Vivian Goldman, William Sanderson, and Nick DeSemlian. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, why not subscribe to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods? And please make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Special thanks to producer Brad Kohlberg.
He hates these cans! Stay away from the cans!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
On my honor, with Almighty God as my witness, I am not an angel dust dealer.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
I once knew a guy who could have been a great golfer. Could have gone pro. Decided to go to college instead.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
Oh, nice shooting, Tex.